Greetings, fellow traveler. As humanity awakens and evolves, we see change in every aspect of our lives. Let's consciously manifest our desires. I am Candace Craw Goldman, and this is New Earth Journey.
Greetings and welcome. Tonight's episode of New Earth Journey is the 21st one, and it is April 26th, 2016. And it's a really interesting evening because here in Kansas, we are having storms go through with lots of tornado watches, tornado warnings, hail, thunder, and thunderstorms. And 25 years ago, the same thing was happening, and a really big tornado hit this area, and people still talk about it. It was devastating. There was lots of people who lost their lives, lots of injuries, etc. And wouldn't you know it, 25 years to the day, we have some similar weather going on. And that is actually some of what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about storm preparedness with your pets and livestock. And tonight I have with me my good friend and the very best vet in Kansas, if you ask me, and that is Dr. Jessica Harrison. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you, Candace.
I'm so glad you got here. You know, when I saw you rushing out of your parking lot earlier this afternoon when I was there picking up my cat, I know you were off to a farm call, and I knew the weather was coming in, and I wondered if we'd be doing the show together via phone or at all if the electricity was going to go out. So, but for the moment, right now, I mean, look outside, like there's not even a whole lot of wind at the moment, so it's very calm for the show. So, way to go, manifesting the calmness.
I know, right? It is. It's beautiful.
Yeah. So. You know, we started out this morning, I asked my really good friend, Mike Smith. Mike Smith's U.S. weather expert. He and I used to work together. Mike Smith was the weatherman at KSNW-TV. 25 years ago, he was covering the storm on air, and I was watching YouTube of it a little bit ago. He actually, Jessica, had been planning for weeks to give a presentation about this tornado, how things have improved, you know, safety, all of that stuff, stories about the tornado in Andover tonight. And of course, they canceled it.
Because of the storm.
Because of the storms. And primarily because some of the people from McConnell Air Force Base who were going to be at the presentation, I guess, had to move airplanes.
Yeah.
So they just decided, well, better just cancel this. So, and I was upset that I was going to miss his show. I said, Mike, I'm going to miss your show because I'm going to be doing my own show. And now his got canceled. But so we were talking about storms, all kinds of things about storms. And one of my very first questions that I had this morning was about my barn. I have this horse barn, and it's very much situated primarily the long part is east to west, but it's very, there's windows and openings on all four sides. And then the question was, well, what's the best thing to do? You know, open up so that the wind goes through, which directions, close it all up. And so tell me your thoughts and what some of the stuff that you've heard and what you think about, and I'll talk to you about what Mike said to me too about.
Yeah, I would like to hear what Mike said too. We kind of discussed this earlier. I will just start with my own personal thoughts, like what I do with my animals and my situation, and then kind of extrapolate into maybe other people's situation, because it's hard to make a right or a wrong answer, especially if it's an unpredicted situation. You know, severe storms, as we know, can pop up pretty quick. They're still hard to predict, even with all of the technology that we have. So if you have a barn and your animals are used to being in the barn, usually best case scenario, in my opinion, is to put them in the barn and close the barn up. What happens when you leave animals in the barn and leave, you know, windows and doors open? is it basically, especially with, you know, rotating winds, it just basically turns it into a giant umbrella. That's how roofs get ripped off. Not saying that, you know, an F5 is obviously going to obliterate any standing building, but luckily those don't come down the street every day. With most severe thunderstorms, you know, winds in excess of, you know, 70, 80 miles an hour, closing the animals up in there is my personal preference, especially if I can get them, if I can get them in there, if I leave them in, if there's a chance for that storm that day. Part of my reasoning for that is most animals will not, if you just give them the option to go in or stay like out in a pasture situation, if it hails, hail on a tin roof is really loud and most animals are opposed to that and they will stay out in the hail, whether it's, you know, softball sized or what. And most of the time a tree is not going to shield them from the effects of that. So that's why my preference is to leave them in. My animals handle it fine if they're in the stall, and yet kind of the original start of the noise scares them, but then they handle it fine. But they would not willingly go in their outdoor three-sided mm-hmm. lean-to in a hailstorm. That noise would scare them. They'd run out. Mm-hmm. But there are folks out there that would rather have the animals outside because if something were to come, they are, you know, scared of the barn collapsing on the animals, the roof being, you know, ripped off and collapsing. And so, I mean, that's a legitimate fear too. I think that we see less of that with, so usually the animals that are the most injured after a severe storm like that are the ones that are outside. Debris definitely can get picked up and thrown at them. They're definitely not as sheltered. Lightning is a big one that kills a lot of livestock. Obviously you can't round up several hundred head of cattle and put them in a barn. So that's, you know, something that happens. Animals are innately pretty good at going to an appropriate area during a storm, but sometimes that's not available. It's usually a little bit lower. They will go into trees, but if you'll notice, they don't go stand under the one tall tree in the pasture. They tend to get to a lower area with a lot of trees. There's less risk of being hit by lightning there. So they innately do know where to go, but sometimes that's not an option in their enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
So
how, I know your husband takes care of a lot of cattle around here. So, you know, how often does a cow, a steer have a problem with being beat up by hail? I mean, does that even ever happen? I mean, how do you even know?
I think they probably do. Cattle have pretty thick hides, and they really tolerate. I think they probably actually tolerate weather better than horses do. We have not had large enough hail in the last 20 years that I've lived here to really see that.
Would you knock on some wood right now?
Yes. Sorry. Yeah, that's a good idea. Whoops. We don't want to bring that one.
I'm sorry.
No, but I mean, we do have large enough hail. Large animals are not as affected by it as like small animals. So, I mean, a golf ball sized hail will absolutely and does kill like small animals, especially under 10 pounds. If all it has to do is hit them in the head once and it will kill them instantly.
That's it.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I've been really lucky with the hail around here so far. And right now my horses are shut up in the barn. We were thinking about letting them out before the show, but they're going to hang out there till we get done. You know, the thing about shutting them up though is, and of course it's April now and the weather's cool. It did get up, I think, in the low 80s today. Mm-hmm. But you know, how about on those hot days, mm-hmm. those really hot days in August when some of this kind of weather comes through? I mean, I'm imagining shutting up the horses in that amazingly hot metal mm-hmm. box in August. And, well, you can do it for a little while. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, that's not very smart. I mean,
and that's a good point. And that's why, you know, sometimes that's why there really isn't in a perfect world, we'd leave the barn open until it looked like the storm was coming and then we'd go close them up. But, you know, with jobs and mm-hmm. life, like sometimes that doesn't happen. So I would probably still put mine in the barn rather than outside, or I ideally strive to do that. But that's just me. You know, I don't worry about them as much when they're in the barn. If they were outside, lightning is probably one of my biggest ones. And that's my situation because my pasture is very open. It's pretty much all grass. There really isn't a low area. They have a three-sided shelter, but again, I'm 100% sure they'd go running out of it if it hailed on them. So that's my biggest thing is probably the lightning side or any, you know, flying debris. So at least they would be inside the barn for that.
I thought we'd take a moment and kind of reminisce about what did happen 25 mm-hmm. years ago. I was a young mother living actually at the time with my husband and a pretty newborn infant son and a very small daughter in New Jersey. And so we weren't here, but my parents were here. and you were here and you were just in first grade, mm-hmm. and that's really aging me just saying that. I already had two kids while you were in first grade, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. But you've got some interesting stories, and I've got one or two too. So what? How do you remember the tornado? You were just right down the road from it. Mm-hmm. It went through my parents' neighborhood. My dad wasn't even at home. He was traveling. Mom was at home. She got over to the neighbors, and everything was okay. But my mom and dad live in a subdivision. There's 57 houses in that subdivision, and I believe it's 52 either were wiped off, you know, their foundations, or had such severe damage that there needed major rebuilding. And there was only a handful of houses that didn't sustain that damage. And my mom and dad's was one of them. And at the time they thought, oh, that's really great, except for, you know what? I don't know about that, because their roof, I think, was compromised, and there was so much small stuff, little garbage stuff going on there. And I've got some stories about what they told me about, but I'd like to hear how you remember it being in first grade. And of course, your dad, you know, was the vet in town. Yeah. So how did it affect you, your family, and your animals, and your dad's clients' animals? What do you remember about that day?
It had hit after school. So I was home, and my sister was still at home at that. I have an older sister, and she was home then. I think it was around, it had to have been around 3:30 or 4 o'clock. And I remember my mom was on the phone. We have a really big, or my parents have a big picture window that faces, to the west. And I remember we had literally my first grade teacher we had learned about tornadoes that day, like that morning. Wow. But, you know, the pictures that we had were, you know, these ropes, you know, coming out of the sky. And this, by the time we could see it from my house, it had already hit, it was hitting McConnell Air Force Base, and it had really picked up, it had basically become classified as an F5 at that point. So it was, it was a half a mile wide.
Yeah, a half a mile wide on the ground.
Yeah.
That's,
it doesn't, it doesn't even, it looks like a cloud. I mean, it just looks like a storm rolling in from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking out the window, and I saw it first. My sister was watching a soap opera, completely oblivious to the crawler at the bottom of the screen that said, if you live in Andover, take cover now. My mom was on the phone. So I remember running, I had toy horse, briar horses that I played with. So I was running them along the back of the couch. And I remember looking at it and just being like, I wonder what that is. And I put my horses down. And Shanna didn't seem concerned, but I remember going up to my mom and tugging on her, and it was one of those mom things like that. So I went back and played with my horses and watched it. And I remember thinking that there were birds flying around this big black cloud. Well, it weren't birds. It was picking up some of the aircraft that was out at McConnell. It was literally picking them up and flinging whatever other debris it had picked up. So then I heard my mom say, cause she was on the phone with my grandma at the time. And I heard her say, you said a tornado just hit Hayesville? Well, I better get off the phone. That's pretty close. So she gets off the phone. I remember she took one step into the living room, looked out the window, looked at the TV, and looked at us and was like, oh my God, that's a tornado. And I remember being like, oh no, that's not, I can't be a tornado.
doesn't look like a picture in the coloring book, right?
Right. And I just remember I remember being upset because I left my briar horse. I knew what tornadoes could do. And I remember having to leave my cat at the time and cats at the time and my toys. And she yanked me up by the back of my shirt. I grabbed my sister, and we did not have a basement at the time. My neighbors didn't have a basement either, but they had a cellar. So she took us over there. They had no idea this was going on either. I mean, this is the tornado sirens did not go off because there was an electrical outage because of the tornado somewhere. So we had no tornado siren. And they were running emergency vehicles up and down the road, but we didn't realize that that's what that was for because we were inside the house. We couldn't hear their loudspeaker, but we got over to the neighbor's cellar. They had so much stuff piled on top of that cellar door. It was basically, they were storing stuff on top of it. So my mom runs in their house and is like, Sue, we need to get in your cellar right now. And she was like, why? There's a tornado out there. So at this point, I mean, it's coming closer. And I mean, our neighbors have huge cottonwood trees in their front yard. And I mean, those things were just blowing everywhere. So I remember I didn't see any more of the tornado from that point forward. Because as soon as they were done ripping things off of the cellar, they shoved me and Shanna down there and closed the door and proceeded to go outside and watch the rest of it. So I wasn't sure if I was like, gonna come, like, are we coming back out of here? But, you know, we came back out, and the rest of that, I remember, you know, we called Dad because the clinic is down in Rose Hill, which is probably another, you know, 5-6 miles south of my parents' house.
And Jessica's dad's the vet at the time.
Yes.
So, he's at work.
Yeah. And they were getting, and it's so funny because we had this hail saved in the fridge for almost 15 years until we had a power outage or an electrical outage at my parents' house and everything in the freezer melted. But we literally, it was softball size hail. I'm not even kidding. Softball
you
size
saved
hail.
Saved hail from the storm.
Dad brought it home because
he was
like, look at this. You're never going to believe this. I mean, it almost totaled his truck and pretty much everybody else's vehicles that were parked down there at the time. Massive roof damage. That was pretty much the only thing that went down at the clinic, though, luckily. But that night, my grandparents had cattle at a major intersection in Andover, and that intersection was basically obliterated. So they went up and they were trying to catch the cattle, and the human injuries were incredible. I mean, I just remember people being like, you know, people walking around with, I mean, like huge gashes, mm-hmm. just trying to find other people, mm-hmm. find their pets, find help. And my mom ended up going to the emergency room with one older lady that couldn't find her family, but she had this like another softball size hematoma like on her forehead. I mean, it was pretty awful. And then driving around, I mean, it took a long, long time to put everything back together, but people
did.
I mean,
there was,
and that's the funny thing about, you know, we say put horses in barns and everything. There were there's always so many amazing stories with tornadoes. I mean, and you can still Google them, especially right now, since so many people have been searching the Andover tornado right now. There's pictures of wheat shoved through trees. There's a picture of a horse standing in a swimming pool. He's completely unharmed. I think that horse actually belonged to another kid that went to Andover High School. And then there's another story.
Was there water in
the pool? Yep, there's water in the pool. He was standing in the shallow end, completely unscathed.
Wonder if he got moved there or went there.
I know exactly. Who knows? But there's another horse that was tied to a post in the barn, and the barn is gone. The horse is standing tied to the post with not a mark on him. Barn's gone. I mean, gone. There's the only thing left is the foundation and this horse tied to this post.
That's a God moment.
Right?
If I've ever heard one.
I know. It's incredible. And then, you know, stories like your parents were how the next door neighbor's house is leveled and this one is.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. Mom and Dad's, they had a couple of patio sets out there. One was wrought iron metal and mm-hmm. one was, you know, that cheap plastic stuff, mm-hmm. right? And the wrought iron got moved, twisted, and left. And one of the plastic chairs didn't move. It was just
a plastic chair.
A plastic chair.
That's
didn't
amazing.
Move while the metal was taken. And I don't know, there were these people, I believe their last name was Becker. We've got a dog here and he's getting ready to make some noise and I'm going to move him. Hey, don't do it. Lay down. Come on, lay down here. Pardon me for that interruption, but he was getting ready to scratch his ear so loud it would have sounded like he was banging on drums. Lay down, dog. Okay. The dog loves Jessica so much, there's no place to put the dog during the show unless he can see Jessica. Anyway, the Beckers, I believe, was their name. And it was either next door to them or it was them. They had a Cocker Spaniel. Cocker Spaniel was in a doghouse. Off of 127th Street, which is, you know, right where the neighborhood, right where it came through on its way to Andover. And when the aftermath was over, and this is one of the things we're talking about today is, you know, people go outside and one of the first things, you know, our pets are our family and, you know, where are our pets? And they went out to look for the Cocker Spaniel and they couldn't find it. And when they're out there looking, somebody sees the house up in the tree. And then they just, you know, they just lose all hope. And it's just this really sad thing until like 2 days later, they hear some whimpering. The dog was in the house.
No way.
Way up in the tree. And they had to go get a cherry picker to get him out. And
he
was fine.
He
was fine.
He was stuck in the tree.
Talk about
in
like,
his house.
Yeah, talk about it. It's like, it's a Wizard of Oz moment.
No,
right?
For sure.
with the thing going up there. So.
Oh my gosh, he was in the tree.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So, but a lot of pets go missing during these kind of storms, don't they? What's your advice? I mean, is there something that we can all do?
Microchip.
What about horses?
Microchip. I've actually had several folks that have been microchipping them lately for that exact reason, because it's a way to identify them in those situations.
Mm-hmm. Is there a low-tech way? I mean, microchipping.
Yeah.
Is there a low-tech way that you find works? I know sometimes people braid things in mane do something. What kind of things have you heard?
Yeah, so, a lot of them have been posted on Facebook recently. That's the cool thing about social media nowadays. Taking a cattle ear tag and braiding it into the mane with, you know, your name and mm-hmm. phone number and maybe the horse's name. I mean, you can put quite a bit of information on that. And it's braided in, so, you know, hopefully it would stay in a situation where they escaped. We've had some people experiment with kind of wax oil-based markers, white marker for a darker colored horse, black one, for mm-hmm. appropriate colors, and just writing, you know, your phone number on their sides. You know, obviously if they're injured, like we said, if they roll in the mud, that might cover it up. But you know, things like that might help get your pet back to you. You know, I'm not an advocate of leaving a halter on them or something like that. I mean, that's a way for them to get stuck, but, you know, braiding an ear tag in, you know, yes, it might get ripped out, but it might not. And that would be a way for them to be able to identify your horse later.
I don't leave halters on my horses either, but I've got a couple leather ones, and I have one that's, you know, the breakaway mm-hmm. that's nylon with the little leather tab.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about breakaway halters just in general? Do they work? Have you seen horses get in trouble with breakaway halters?
Yes,
anyway?
For the most part, they break, but, you know, if for some reason they don't break, or it's a horse that isn't going to, you know, if it pulls back and feels resistance, it's not going to pull back and it's stuck somewhere for who knows how long. Mm-hmm. Breakaway halters were made for that, to come loose when they pull back. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that's a possibility.
And so during the aftermath, I know there was some conversation, again, on mm-hmm. social media today about, you know, what you can do to help, you know, your fellow neighbors, you know, people, but pets as well. There are things that people who have just been through this kind of storm can use mm-hmm. with their pets. What mm-hmm. what kinds of things, if you know that something has happened nearby you, but you've been lucky enough that you've been able to miss the storm, what sort of things can you gather up from your own supplies maybe and go
help?
Yeah, go help. What kind of things do you think would be useful for, you know, to come share with your neighbors if they've gotten hit by a storm?
Yeah. People in general, I mean, a lot of times you just need a hand with picking up, helping find things. You know, back in 1991, we didn't have social media to put, you know, this lost this. So a lot of people would just put, you know, signs up.
We didn't have cell phones.
No.
Exactly. I mean, I didn't even talk to my mom for 2 days. Yeah, it was is she even alive?
You didn't know if anyone was alive.
It was scary. Yeah. You have to wait that long.
That's incredible. Yeah. It's incredible to think mm-hmm. of that, you know, we can just pick up the phone and call. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of, especially for on the pet side, you know, a lot of them get picked up by the local animal control, a lot of the shelters. Calling, donating food, you know, to them is certainly helpful. Same with people. I mean, you know, a lot of local churches and senior centers will, you know, try to help provide food and, you know, help. I mean, there's pretty much, the ways to help are pretty much endless.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you find a stray pet, you know, if you want to foster it yourself and, you know, say whose it is, or, you know, calling local shelters, putting up an ad, you know, this is the pets that we found. There's also a lot of animal response teams. I know that, like, there's a Butler County one, and there's a Sedgwick County animal response team. And, like, if you find an animal that's, you know, trapped somewhere and you want to help it, you know, just on the off chance of we don't want you to get bit.
Right.
So it's always a good idea to call those folks in. They've been trained to handle it. They're great at their job. They love doing that job mm-hmm. and they can, they're going to have a much better success rate of maybe getting the animal out. And not getting, you know, not themselves getting bit and the animal not getting hurt too. So
mm-hmm. one of the things that's been on my mind as we've been approaching tornado season, and I've seemed to be collecting more pets is, you know, having enough carriers for, mm-hmm. for all, you know, you might have one cat carrier and
yes.
several cats because only one at a time mm-hmm. goes to the vet or something, but, you know, having one for everybody or yep. more to get them into safety
right.
is really kind of a smart thing. And just recently, I've been training my barn cats to go into a little wire cage because, you know, they really weren't very amenable going into any kind of cage.
No, they were not.
And I had to do this elaborate trapping thing. But now I'm feeding them in these cages so that I can just, you know, close the door when I want to take them somewhere. So that's certainly something that, you know, is reasonable to have on hand. But a lot of animals get displaced after big storms like this.
They do, unfortunately.
Don't they? And some we've never... you know, don't ever hear from them again. I know, Jess, you took care of our daughter's cats when she was here. And those were Hurricane Katrina cats.
Aww.
Yeah, so they were given up to a shelter. And I think more than once, they were adopted out and then returned and adopted out again. Yes, so they just were one of those pair of cats that just kind of showed up, you know, and needed someplace to go after a storm. So, well, what are the dangers of what might be out there after a storm for
pets?
Mm-hmm, probably debris.
A lot of debris. You know, especially like, you know, a typical house pet, you know, they're not going to be great at surviving on their own out there. Most of the water sources are now contaminated, especially, I mean, when a tornado takes a house out, it doesn't just take the house and leave the plumbing and everything hooked up nicely. I mean, there's quite a few hazards to just roaming around that area, broken glass, nail, I mean, everything. So a lot of those pets end up with lacerations, wounds, you know, if they were at all, especially that. Although amazingly, it sounds like that little dog that spent the night in the treehouse.
He was
unintentionally was fine, but you know, it picked up and thrown around with debris. Obviously, can be anything from obviously like that dog, no wounds at all to death. So, I would say that's the biggest thing is, you know, they're out roaming around. They're not, you know, sometimes they can't find food, sometimes they can't find water, and sometimes they've got, you know, injuries varying from minor to severe.
Mm-hmm. So. I know that Mike Smith and other people who, you know, you hear that little chicken in the other room? It's peeping. I've got a little pullet with a broken wing who obviously wants to be on air or something. We've been here for hours.
It hasn't been a peep.
No, now it's over there peeping. It wants to tell its story. Well, you know, the thing about people having sturdy shoes. Well, you know, your pets really can't go out into a debris field without, you know, if they're dogs and cats, you really have to pay attention to that. When the Andover tornado came through mom and dad's yard, my dad was picking up shards of glass and splinters, wood splinters, for literally years. And still, even now, occasionally we'll find something. A nail or something like that. And hey, last time you and Brian were here, no, it wasn't. It wasn't you. It was... No, it was just right now. It was my last dinner guest, and just right now, the noodles I made for our dinner, that pot, that tall steel pot with the brass bottom, that landed in my parents' yard from the Andover tornado.
Get out. That's amazing.
Yeah, I know. And the only thing that, you know, it just didn't come with the lid.
No,
so
I know, right?
I didn't have a lid for it.
Darn it, it didn't take the lid.
I still use that as it's like my favorite pasta pot. It just landed in a lamp. So did you guys get anything in your yard?
No.
We got several very interesting items land in my mom and dad's yard.
We were far enough south that we really didn't get any debris at my parents' house. Mm-hmm. We talked to a lot of people that lived up, you know, like up in Green Valley and the housing developments up there that had everything from cars to, I mean, pictures of people that lived like in Wichita. I mean, it was amazing how much debris got picked up and like just relocated to clear across town.
Mm-hmm. A couple of stories I know that are still passed around in my family is one of the things that landed in mom and dad's yard was a Polish Bible. And they couldn't, you know, there wasn't any way to figure out who it belonged to. I'm not sure whatever happened to that. And then another very, very interesting story was somebody, I think either in the neighborhood or somebody that they knew, weeks later somebody up in Kansas City area found some of their canceled checks in their yard.
In Kansas City?
Yeah. So, you know, stayed in the air and just got transferred. Yeah, and that's a 3-hour drive by car.
I know.
So,
wow.
Yeah, I think that's pretty interesting. What you were saying too before about the stalks of wheat going through trees.
Yeah.
What it really is the tree opens up. The tree is like this splintered open thing, and then things blowing, and then it goes back together like that. Yeah. So those trees, and they looked like they were in blenders. The trees in Mom and Dad's neighborhood. I mean, they looked that way for years.
Yeah.
I mean, you could see it was like a scar, like a path. For years you can see
agreed. Where you can still, like, if you drive down Kellogg and you know where to look, you can sometimes you can still see a couple of them.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. What other kinds of things can we do to prepare? I know, for instance, like right now I've got three of my cats down in the basement.
And yeah, if you have a basement and a severe threat is coming, obviously the...
Well, we had a little interruption there because the clouds are coming in from the west and suddenly internet drops, and now we're finishing out the radio show via cell phone connection rather than Skype and internet connection. But I guess that's appropriate for this evening's topic, right, Jessica?
Yep, very appropriate.
Gosh, you know, what would we even do these days without cell phones? I mean, there is, it keeps us connected and it solves a lot of problems. It keeps us busier, though, doesn't it?
It does. It keeps us a lot busier. And I think to some extent, they're also quite addicting.
Yeah, a little crazy in that way. But happy to have a cell phone to finish out the show tonight. So we've been talking about storm and storm coverage and storm aftermath and all of that. While we were waiting to reconnect, we started talking about some of the stories. Oh, I know what story I wanted to hear about. Your horse.
Oh!
Because it's his birthday, but
he's
gone.
He is, yeah. He's passed away. He would have been 25. He would have been 25 today. And he was my first horse.
So if he's 25 today, he was born.
Yep, on the day of the Andover tornado hit, and he was actually born in the town just south, actually down close by my dad's clinic. So where the farm he was born at was not a hit by the storm, but it was definitely a stormy day. And his name was Justice. But, yep, he was born on April 26, 1991.
You were telling me earlier about the mark he had.
Mm-hmm. So he had, and there's lots of opinions on swirls or whorls on horses' foreheads, but he had two, and he had what would have been a star if he didn't have any whorls. But because he had those whorls, he had basically, it looked like an S, and then it kind of continued faintly down in the front of his face. And so I always thought it looked like his little tornado on his forehead.
Right. Gosh. Now, I wonder, is it kind of like a full moon or anything else? I wonder if animals or whatever, you know, they give birth more.
They do tend to give birth during storms, yeah, and especially in the winter when it snows or it's really, really cold out. But no, it's, I don't know why some people will say it's the barometric pressure change. Who knows? But animals definitely do tend to give birth during inclement weather.
Well, so you've been spending some time on my critters these days, and one of the things you did last week or so is you were here checking the horses for their annual spring checkups with vaccinations, et cetera. I'm not a great fan of all vaccinating all the time in every reason and with all of those numbers, but we come up with our own plan and our own compromise. And so what did you give my horses for vaccinations this year?
So your horses basically just received what we call core vaccines. And core vaccines are basically vaccinations we recommend to all horses, regardless of what they do. And the reason is all horses are exposed to these bugs no matter what they do. So rabies is a big one. Rabies is, without wildlife carrying it, would probably not be here anymore because the vaccine is so effective. We always say no vaccine is 100%, but the rabies vaccine is pretty darn close. And how effective a vaccine is depends on the organism itself that we're vaccinating for, you know, how good are we at getting it into a vaccine and having the animal then respond to it. You know, it's life cycle outside the host, in the wildlife, et cetera. But the rabies vaccine is definitely an important one. And rabies vaccine, you know, that is a zoonotic, meaning transmissible between human and animal, disease, and it is fatal. It is more fatal than Ebola if you get rabies, and it's not a pleasant death. So that is definitely one that we recommend. Even as an insurance policy, we get a lot of people that say, and this is not on necessarily the horse side, but that, well, you know, my horse is in the barn all the time, or my cat never leaves the house. Well, most people are unaware that the number one rabies transmitting animal is a bat. And that includes Kansas skunks are pretty high up there. But bats absolutely can come in the house, and a lot of times you never even know they bit you. It's a very, very tiny bite. A lot of times you'll hear stories they came down the chimney flue, or they just ended up in the room through an open window kind of deal. So definitely, definitely still recommend rabies. And then most rabies vaccines, with the exception of large animals, most rabies vaccines are every 3 year now. So I think that was definitely a good way to go. We've discovered animals maintain that immunity a lot longer than we thought. So the other vaccines that your horses receive were tetanus, West Nile, and both Eastern and Western equine encephalitis. Tetanus, obviously, is that's a bacteria. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere in the soil. Horses, humans, cattle, goats, sheep are all very, very prone to tetanus. Dogs and cats, no. But tetanus is basically a bacteria that sets up shop in a very deep wound. It's an anaerobe, meaning it likes to live somewhere where there's not a lot of air. So that's why a deep puncture wound, not so much stepping on a rusty nail, it's just stepping on a nail and having that really deep penetrating wound. Because that is basically, any deep wound is going to not have as much air in it. So that's where it sets up shop. Foals, with an umbilicus that gets infected, that's, unfortunately, we had a case of that last year and the foal passed away. Tetanus. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's definitely a big one that you want to keep. And that sometimes is more on the yearly side. Yearly is the recommendation from the AAP.
And with people, it's like every 10 years.
Uh-huh. It is.
And last time I got a tetanus shot, I thought I was going to die.
Yeah, it burned.
It wasn't that. I was sick. And what was really interesting is I remember I laid in bed for 2 days, mm-hmm. and I couldn't move my head.
Oh.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, I'm past my 10 years, but I'm afraid to get another tetanus shot.
I don't blame you.
I'm actually really, really afraid to get another. I'm not sure I will. And I remember asking my doctor, I was like, does that mean I had a bad reaction? And I remember my doctor saying, no, it's just a really nasty shot for some people.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, one of the things that I read about tetanus was it was mostly like it was carried by a lot of feces or dirt. But animal feces.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep. I mean, that's the way that works.
Exactly, yeah. Dirty deep wounds is usually what happens.
But then we checked them also for worms, mm-hmm. and we checked the horse's teeth to see if they need to be floated. And mm-hmm. we had a conversation about new ideas about teeth floating with horses, which
yes.
is what?
Yeah, so the recommendations used to be that, you know, horses under the age of 7 probably needed their teeth floated twice a year, and if they were over the age of 15 or 16, they probably needed to be floated twice a year, or at least examined. And anywhere in between there once a year would be fine. And we've definitely seen, or at least I have seen here, certain breeds, you know, depending on how the horse is kept, is it stalled, is it outside grazing most of the time, all of those circumstances come into play as to how often your horse needs their teeth floated. I think a yearly exam is definitely warranted. And probably with young growing horses, since they're, you know, they're shedding caps, they're, you know, losing baby teeth, things are changing, it's always easier to fix something when it first happens rather than let it go on for a while. So I think probably checking a, you know, any horse that's 5, 6 years old and under, probably a good idea to check them twice a year. And in between there, at least yearly, there's nothing wrong with just looking in the horse's mouth to check. We have some horses that go 4 or 5 years before they need to be floated that are in the middle years because they're outside. They're grazing on roughage. They're not in a stall, only eating a concentrated feed twice a day. Mm-hmm. And I think actually out grazing really does help, not just in a stall eating hay and grain. I think even if you give a horse free choice hay, in my experience, those horses still need to be floated once, sometimes twice a year.
So, you know, I remember wondering and talking to my vet about this years ago about, well, okay, well, what about the wild Mustangs? Mm-hmm. What about the wild horses? You know, nobody's running them down and floating their teeth. And, you know, how does that work? And I remember a lot of the answers that came back to me was, well, that's why they don't live as long. And I remember thinking, but see, what you're saying right there is their natural habitat and their natural way of living.
A natural.
Their teeth down.
Well, a natural selection. If a horse does not have good dentition, it doesn't live very long in the wild, and therefore it's not going to procreate and continue the process. You know, and as far as, you know, not having, those guys don't really have their hooves done either. And I've got several clients that have adopted some from BLM, land, actually my technician on some. And they, for the most part, they tend to have pretty good hoof walls. I mean, basic trimming is okay. They don't necessarily need shoes, especially if they're ridden without them and accustomed to it. One of my favorite ones is I have a group that has semi-Atlantic ponies, and those things are incredible. I mean, they wear their teeth well. They wear their feet well. They're just incredible.
Hardy.
Yeah, incredible, sturdy, hardy little animals.
Wow. Well, happily, we went through the barn, and none of my guys, there were five of them out there, none of them needed
blooded this year. Yeah.
And they didn't, some did
last year. Yes. Yeah.
But the one horse.
There's one that is not, has not needed floated for quite a while.
And she's the
4
one.
4 years, actually, right?
Yeah, and she's the one who, I remember you saying something like, it's a record or it'll be a record next year.
She'll be the one next, if she goes for a full 5 years, she will have the record for not needing her teeth floated. So.
This is a very opinionated horse I have in my barn. She didn't want to have her teeth floated. Remember I think it was like the first year, it was like.
And she's still the only horse I have not been able to get in. I can get any horse into the stocks, and she is the only horse. Even with, this is, you know, people are probably like, oh, you know, just sedate her or put a belt rope. She has had massive amounts of sedation, enough where, you're approaching, possible other side effects. So, I mean, somebody else out there might give her more, I don't know. But literally, you cannot get her in the stock.
This is an astonishing horse on many levels. And then what I do, you know, a lot of people out there give wormers every 30 days or every 60 days. And, oh, man, have I not liked that. And so we've decided to do... you know, I collect the manure balls and I get them to you as soon as I can. And I put them in the refrigerator so I can make my trip out there. I usually do it in the morning. I bring everyone in, give them hay, keep them separated, put them in the stalls, get my Ziploc bags ready, and I label it all. And as soon as everybody's given me a sample, then I drive, I drive that out to your clinic, and then you guys look under a microscope, and then I see whether or not they need to be wormed. But yeah, we still do a twice a year worming, and so why don't you tell our listeners, why do we do that? If you are looking under the microscope and you're not seeing any worms, why are we still doing that twice a year?
And that's an awesome question. So, horses eat off the ground. And there are several different parasite species that are, once their eggs, their ova, are in the ground, they're there for life. So they're constantly exposed to it. So thinking that by deworming your horse every 30 to 60 days, you're keeping all parasites out of their system ever is, it just doesn't happen. There's going to be some parasite in there that eat off the ground. But what we want to do is keep that to a minimum. And one thing that we know is the horse's innate immune system is actually very, very responsible and very helpful in keeping those parasite burdens to a minimum. So usually when we have a parasite issue, very frequently in the very young or the very old or the immunocompromised horses that have PPI, you know, pituitary parts intermediate, used to be known as Cushing's. But what we've discovered is we are starting to see resistance, because what happens when we deworm them? Do we kill every single worm in the horse? No. So who's left behind?
A strong one.
Exactly. So every 30 to 60 days, you're just making them stronger. And we absolutely do have documentation of resistance to ivermectin with strongyle parasites in the Kentucky and the Ohio River area. And that's going to spread until we get so many clients that are like, and I will try to say, let's just run a fecal and see what we're doing. I mean, not only is it going to save you money, because you're not going to be spending money on dewormer every 60 days, it's better for your horse. You know, $28 for us to run a fecal, and we usually do yours like twice a year. So what we're looking for on the fecal are parasites that have eggs that are passed in the feces. So that's going to be Strongyle, also known as, you know, the hookworm type, large and small. We're looking for roundworms, which are usually not a problem, except in younger horses, sometimes older, or horses that have just never been dewormed. If we don't see those, it doesn't mean your horse is parasite-free, and this is where we get into why we still will always usually recommend deworming twice a year, and that's in the spring and the fall, and that is because of tapeworms and botulism. So neither of those will really, tapeworms usually set up shop in the cecum, usually not responsible for any health issues.
What's the cecum?
The cecum is basically your appendix, except in a horse, it's like 20 times the size, and actually has a job, unlike in the human horse. It's a little vestigial,
sits there
and causes appendicitis.
Whoa, that was a really close lightning.
Yeah, we know. Super close lightning.
Yeah, woo!
They really don't cause a big problem. They're usually picked up by a mite that's in the grain. But we do still deworm for them because if they become too abundant, then we can't still have a problem. So that's something in botflies, also something we do deworm for in the late fall after the first freeze. Mm-hmm. And then again in the spring, kind of same thing with those too. Mm-hmm. So just twice a year for those guys. And then we usually try to tailor the deworming protocol for the rest of it. And what that is that's really aimed at roundworms and Strongyle. And so when we're doing a fecal and why say, you know, we say, oh, you know, no ova or no parasite seen, we don't really say a negative fecal because that would usually insinuate that there are no parasites in your animal at all. And that's like we discussed earlier, that's not the case. But that just means we really don't need to deworm that animal at that time for a Strongyle type egg. And that's going to be, you know, from April all the way up through, you know, October. I have several clients who were deworming every 30 to 60 days, and now we're just on a twice-a-year schedule, and we still do not have a Strongyle issue. So I'm absolutely sure that, you know, in a healthy horse, they really do a pretty good job of keeping those parasites out on their own.
And what we do here at Tierman Farm is we feed food-grade diatomaceous earth along with their grain once a day, been very helpful. So that's good. You know, the worms are kind of everywhere. I don't know if you remember this, when Finn, our beastla, who showed up at the farm, but he was here just a few days when I don't know if we wormed him or if it just happened, but he, like, vomited a whole, like, pile. I think that was roundworms,
right?
Yeah, it
was roundworms, yep.
Yeah, that was so awful. When I walked in, the first thing I saw is on the floor, it looked like somebody had served him like a file skit of spaghetti, you know, a serving of spaghetti. It was the one of the more disgusting things. But who knows how long that dog was out on the run like that. And then just recently, with a couple of the barn cats, we treated them for tapeworm because I noticed that one of them, one of the barn cats, had thrown up a tapeworm. And we talked a little bit that the tapeworm comes from the barn cat killing probably a rodent and eating rodent. So talk to me about this because, you know, I'm living in an old farmhouse that's got a few holes here and there. Okay, it just blinked again. The whole electricity blinked there. Okay, there's power surges going on in here. One just went through my body with that one. So the idea that I wanted to talk about is, you know, the occasional mouse that gets in and that my house cat kills. It started to make me wonder about tapeworm possibilities in any of my house cats. They're not eating the mice, but every once in a while, you know, in their little cattery or, if it comes in and they get a little mouse, but I've not ever had to worm the house cat. I mean, or is that something, what do you have to say about that?
So they have to actually ingest the muscle tissue from the mouse in order to get the tapeworm.
Okay.
Is how the life cycle goes. And there's also another way to get tapeworms, and that is ingesting a flea. So there's there's more than two different species of tapeworms the dogs and cats can get, but we'll just focus on those two for right now. So the most common ones are either from eating a, you know, rodent, you know, rabbit, rat, mouse that's infected with it, or eating a flea, and that is the flea tapeworm.
Well, you figured that they eat a lot of fleas if they're eating fleas and they're chewing on fleas. They're probably swallowing fleas, and they don't see many fleas out here.
No, we don't. And that's another reason that, you know, a lot of people are, well, I just want to deal with the tapeworm and be done. Well, if the animal has a severe flea infestation, that's probably where it got the tapeworms, and it's just going to come right back. So, and we can actually tell which tapeworm it is by that little rice-looking segment that gets stuck to their rear end, so we can actually see. So those eggs don't actually show up. Like if you bring a fecal exam in, usually we won't see a tapeworm egg on the fecal. We have to actually get, it's called a little perglottid. We have to get that little
piece
of the worm.
Which is why you do the worming on the horses even without seeing the egg.
Exactly, because those ones are hard to find.
Yeah, and then, you know, we go through all this conversation and I think, well, gosh, what did they even do 100 or 200 years ago? Well, they didn't do anything. They were wormy and they probably didn't live as long. But
exactly.
Didn't they have a better chance of it if they were moving, if they're constantly,
that's why
new ground, so it's confined animals.
It is. It's confinement, absolutely. Confinement creates all kinds of diseases.
Which is another reason why, you know, the food animals in the factory farms, when they're in feedlots and really, really small areas, that it's, well, it's people too.
It
puts people in small places where there isn't any, sanitation and not enough room to move around and have clean water and everything. And you're going to have a lot of disease.
Exactly.
Too. So, wow, the storms are really kind
picking
of
up, aren't
they? Yeah, they are coming in. So we had another adventure here lately at the farm. My very special, very elusive black barn kitty had an eye injury, and this cat was around for literally almost 5 years before I could pet it, and I got pretty good at petting it last summer, and then I really practiced petting every day, petting this cat over the winter because I was so excited he finally let me touch him, and then I was, practice petting him a lot because in the winter you usually have a big winter coat and a glove on and a football
right?
swipe at me and the whole time I would do that first off it was a wonderful challenge, you know, it was like I mean, because he was just as wild as any wild animal out there, and in some ways more wild and I would always think, well, someday maybe if you get hurt it'll be good if you let me touch you so that I can help you, and that's exactly what happened. We started off with, we still have enough time to talk about this. We have a few minutes left. Several of the cats in the barn, their eyes got goopy, and you said, well, it's probably
herpes virus.
And so brought home some drops, and at first it was like, will he let me give him drops? I mean, you know, I thought, oh, my God,
no
is
way.
He easier? And I did it, put the food down, and I kind of pet him, and then I just tried to do it real fast, and I was amazing.
Yeah.
He let me. And then towards the end of that treatment plan, I looked at the one eye, and what must have happened was he got injured by, and it looked like from another cat, and there was another cat here. And that cat had been coming and going, and we had trapped, neutered him, and released him in the barn. But that cat was named Calvin, and the cat with the eye injury and named Samson. And I think Calvin, you know, took a swipe at Samson and really injured his eye and trapped Samson, brought him in to see you, and you were concerned that you might lose his eye.
Yeah, it was a very, very deep corneal ulcer. And herpes virus ulcers are pretty tricky because unless you can get them on an oral medication, famciclovir, which is an oral antiviral, there really is no topical that will fix it. In fact, it usually just sometimes will irritate it. It'll prevent a secondary bacterial infection from setting up shop, but they really, a topical will heal it. And that's why, you know, when his eye just kept getting worse instead of better. So many times you want to just change the medication and just keep trying something else. In that case, you just change your diagnosis. It obviously was not just a corneal ulcer, the herpes ulcer. So obviously we wanted to try to save his eye, and it was very, very deep. He was basically down to the last little tiny layer of cornea before his eye would have ruptured, basically. So we did an unconventional treatment there. So there are usual treatments for an ulcer like that, and there are unconventional ones. And since he was I mean, he's kind of a feral guy. He's not one that we could have put in the hospital and treated there because we would have had to anesthetize him every time we wanted to mess with him.
He wouldn't have left.
Which is not in his best interest. So we had to do something.
90 seconds.
That we had to do something minimal. So I'll wrap it up real quick. We basically ended up just kind of partially closing his whole eyelid and left him for 3 weeks. Candace still medicated him. We started him on the famciclovir, and we just took his sutures out today, and he's looking awesome.
My feral cat. We're running out of time, and the storm is coming in. And Jessica, there's always so much to talk with you about. I mean, we could talk about my animals and your animals all day long. Will you come back another time?
I'm looking forward to it. I hope you'll have me.
Well, thank you so much. And this is Jessica Harrison from Rose Hill Vet Clinic in Rose Hill, Kansas, the best vet around. Her and her husband, Brian, and her dad, Reed, and we just have so much fun together, and I love stopping over there, and they take the best care of all the animals around here, large and small. So thank you, everyone, for listening, and tune in a couple weeks from now, and until then, all shall be well. Good night.